This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
So, okay, what do you want to talk about? And it need not be closely related to, you know, the last few lectures and that kind of thing. If it is, so much the better. But yes.
I'll start us off. This was not this last lecture, but maybe a couple back. We were talking about the inerrancy of the Gospels, and you said something like it's not necessarily transcribed verbatim, but like the condensation or like the implication at a later point. And I was just wondering, you know, when you read, you know, Jesus said or John said, is there wiggle room in there in terms of condensation and implication, as in maybe John Baptist didn't really say there's the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world? You know, do we need to believe that those were his exact words?
Yeah, okay.
Or something very equivalent.
Right. Yeah. Good question. The trouble is, in some respects, a tricky question. Not that you're intending to trick anybody, but a tricky to answer, because it's a very delicate matter. And it's pretty close to the surface. And I think you could feel this kind of existentially, that if you take the wrong view, you can easily undermine a lot of what Scripture is doing, particularly because the words of Jesus are precious to us. You know, what do we say about that? And I wish I could just tell you, well, read my book, Inerrancy in the Gospels. Because the advantage, I'm not going to cop out, you know, I think that would be a cop out. But the advantage of doing it that way, I mean, I'm going to try to speak sort of, because we've got the space to do it, a little more pastorally, that there are some kind of situations of communication where face-to-face works. I looked at something a while ago on the internet where somebody, it was a pastoral type, was saying when not to use email, and saying if you've got a tense relationship with another person, face to face, take the time. Don't even do it on the phone unless, you know, they're on the other side of the country. Face to face. There are times when that face-to-face, you do things that you can't do in a letter or an email and so on, and vice versa, because the written medium is easier for people to slow down and to digest things that they wouldn't take in a moment, right? So, and it's easy to spread out what you have to say. And this particular element, I had trouble the first time writing it up in the Gospels, I'll tell you, you know, in that book. I had first real trouble writing it up. And I don't think I got it right in terms of communication. My own mind didn't change. So I do think it's delicate. And the way I would go at it would partly be, actually the way I do it in the book, is to look at New Testament quotations from the Old Testament. And some of those are virtually verbatim the same, although even there it's Greek instead of Hebrew, and so the word order will be a little bit different. You know, if you get really, really fussy, then
you have to insist that a quotation be in the original language, right? But some of the things, my house, I think the example I use is, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you made it a den of robbers. And that is practically, you know, word for word, what is there in Isaiah. And Jesus, you know, quotes it. So we're comfortable with that. But the fact that even there, Jesus is doing something, because Isaiah is, and God through Isaiah, is addressing a situation of faithlessness in Israel, which typically involved idolatry and gross disobedience to God. And now in Jesus' time, he's addressing the religious leaders who have made for themselves all kinds of excuses. Now, at a deep level, it boils down to the same thing. False worship is false worship. But, you know, there's some reuse of a principle. And then you look at some other passages and you see that concern for application. As you go from the Old Testament to a New Testament quota, the Old Testament, you see that concern for application leading to a greater amount of rewording. So, you know, and off the top of my head, it's hard to come up with particular examples, but let's deal with a tiny one. And that is in Matthew 11. And let me look to make sure I've got this right. Okay, yeah. Matthew 11:10. Well, Jesus is discussing the ministry of John the Baptist. This is he, that is John, is he of whom it is written, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you." Okay, that's a quote from Malachi 3. You turn over to Malachi 3. "Behold, I send my messenger." I'm doing the English, but the same thing occurs if you go back to the original. Where's the "before my face"? It's not there yet. "And he will prepare the way before me." Instead of you. But of course, you can see what's happening. That you're addressing another person distinct from John the Baptist, and who that is, whether it's second person or first person, depends on who you're addressing. So everybody can understand what Jesus is doing here, right? And he's not claiming to give a word-for-word quotation from Malachi, but he is, in fact, you know, re-expressing it in such a way that it, well, the "you" ultimately is Christ himself, who's, you know, is the one that John the Baptist was preparing for. So, the other thing, and it comes out in my book too, is that, and I don't know how much this will help people, but it is, for some people, I think it does help to point out that Hebrew and Greek of the time in which the Bible was written do not have punctuation marks the way we have them now. Particularly, you don't have quotation marks. And quotation marks in modern English are used to mark out pieces when it's a direct quote, where typically you are giving something verbatim. And the standards in the scholarly world have become very, very strict. And we have all this stuff about plagiarism, right, to make sure, you know, if you put something in your paper, if you have the exact words, you've got to put it in quotes, right? And it's got to be exact, or else, you know, you are falling below this, scholarly standards. Well, there are no quotation marks anywhere in the Greek New Testament, because such thing did not exist in the Greek written language. And in the King James Version, there are no quotation marks. Not many people realize that. But there are in the ESV and in most modern English versions, because it's useful to the reader to have marked out explicitly the part that's being said by the character versus the part that's being said by the narrator, if you will. Well, that gets you into difficulty in John 3, because Jesus replies to Nicodemus and you don't know how far his reply goes. So everybody is guessing, and there's, you know, commentators that you read about that, they're disputing just how far, what is Jesus' words and what is, you know, the author, John, what is he adding to further interpret what Jesus is saying? And it's up for debate because there are no quotation marks in the original, see? But when we put quotation marks in English, we seem to be saying, and it's in the mentality, you know, the whole culture, we seem to be saying what you got is verbatim. Admittedly, okay, translated in another language, but as close as we can possibly get. And to illustrate what's going on in the New Testament quote from the Old Testament, you've got no quotation marks. And sometimes you have these changes. Sometimes you have combinations where the author will put together two passages. For instance, in Mark, chapter 1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." If you go back to the Old Testament, you find that the first part is quoted from Malachi 3 and the second part from Isaiah 40, verse 3. Well, you would never know it, of course, unless you went back. Mark is writing to people who probably know the Old Testament better than most of us. So people take it in stride and say, well, you're dealing with two passages, both of which are talking about John the Baptist prophetically, right? So the obvious thing, it's not a willful kind of pulling together of two passages that have nothing to do with one another. They both are related. In fact, Malachi, the later one of them, is probably building on and alluding back to Isaiah 40. You see, but if you just read it in English, you think, you know, you're falsifying it because you're combining things and you're pretending that it's all, you know, you can get hung up about this. Now, the purpose, the bottom line is that God is quoting God when you think about it, right? And when God is quoting God, he's free to quote himself verbatim, but he's free to re-express the same thing that he said before. And that could be a major re-expression, if you think about it, because he knows what he meant, right? And he can re-say, and he can even draw out implications of what he meant back there that weren't all on the surface the first time he said it. So I think you have to work through, what does it really mean for God to speak truthfully? And also, what is claimed, you know, with the use of quotation marks and all that. And once you do it, I think you can see that the point over and over again throughout the Bible is this is what somebody says, but not necessarily the exact words, because what is really significant is what he says rather than the wording with which he said it. Now, if you take away all the wording, you got nothing, right? But the wording is in the service of meaning. Augustine saw this, and in the book I quote, give some quotes of Augustine. Augustine wrote a whole book called The Harmony of the Evangelists, where he dealt with harmonistic problems. And one of his fundamental principles is it's okay to say something with different wording when the meaning comes out, the same meaning comes out. So, I mean, that's a sort of long way around And you can get sort of modern examples of a report, a newspaper report of, say, the State of the Union speech, right? Major political speech. And those speeches, I don't know, they last something like an hour, right? And they're long things. Now, some newspapers might publish the whole thing verbatim, but another reporter, you know, gives you the gist of it. Now, in the process of giving you the gist of it, he could distort things, you know, he could have his own political biases. On the other hand, it might be actually more useful than the full speech, you know, because, okay, I got the principal ideas, and that's what I need to know. Well, the fundamental issue, I think, that people, that is at the back of people's mind is, can I trust the Bible? And the answer is, you see, the divine authorship is all important there. God knows not only all the meanings in all the depth, right? Every word of every speech of all of history, but of course not all of those are very valuable. But he also knows how to give us knowledge to finite beings that is fully true but not comprehensive. Right? And sometimes I could take the form of what I call a condensation of saying, you know, this is what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, in scholarship, in biblical world, if you go into New Testament scholarship, you will have people trying to reconstruct the exact wording in Aramaic, typically. And then the changes that, you know, layers on top of that. And there's two problems with that, and we're going to discuss actually in the, you know, the non-optional class. We're going to discuss that kind of thing in a bit. But in the atmosphere, if you're not careful, I'm not saying that every scholar who engages in this kind of thing is doing something sub-Christian. But the atmosphere, if you're not careful, goes over in an atmosphere that we really need this reconstruction if we get the most accurate picture of who Jesus was and what he actually said and so on and so on. And in fact, that's not true. There's two problems. One is it is speculative. You can never be sure. And then even if you got it, the fact is that Jesus intended that his word should go somewhere. Right? He, if you believe the Gospels enough to think that Jesus wanted to found a church, right, which he says to Peter, then he's thinking about a future, and he's understanding that he has to die and rise in the middle of history rather than the complete end. Right? So it's going to be the gospel going to nations afterwards. So his words are intended to go somewhere, to go out, and to do that, some of the things that he knows about and that are implied in his words, it is perfectly appropriate that they be unpacked at a later point, partly by the letters, right? When you look at what 2 Peter does with the transfiguration, Peter was there, and Peter talks about it in his own words in a way that's informed not only by what happened, but by spiritual insight into the theological significance of what happen. You see, and that is very valuable. Now, what I want to guard against is the idea that therefore there was a kind of infinite freedom to rewrite everything. And actually, it is impressive how much the Gospels stay with things that look like they're pretty much verbatim. The phrase "Son of Man," for instance, is, it's not something that occurs outside the Gospels, except couple of times in the whole New Testament. And I think there's a reason. Namely, Jesus called himself Son of Man, and the church did not. They used Christ and Son of God. You know, they used a lot of other things. That particular title sort of fell by the wayside historically. And that is, again, the providence of God. Don't worry about it. But the fact is that the Gospels are reproducing something verbatim. But if they do it that time, it doesn't guarantee that everything is exactly that close, because it's a, I think God has the right to do a précis of what he said at an earlier point. And you find, for instance, Stephen's speech. Yeah, here's an example, right? Stephen's speech in Acts 7 is a sort of run through the whole redemptive history virtually, but obviously very, very condensed. Right, so Stephen's speech, well, some people might doubt whether it was actually inspired. I mean, he's a spirit-filled man, but Luke accurately records the speech, right? But does that endorse it? Well, it's pretty near to an endorsement. So, but it's highly condensed, right? We don't get excited about that. It doesn't worry us, because we have the Old Testament. We can go back to the less condensed form, right? But if it was done with Jesus' speeches, and of course, not everything was recorded, right? There's entire speeches. I mean, 3-year ministry, come on, you know. There's this huge number of speeches that are just not in any of the Gospels. But the worrisome thing about the even the possibility of the condensation of a speech is that we don't really have it. It all depends on whether you trust what God is doing in the condensation, see, and saying, I know there's a lot more that you'd like to have in your curiosity, but what I'm giving you is the authentic stuff. It's a real authentic picture of Jesus and his teaching. And, you know, once you rest in that, then you say, I don't need to dig underneath the Gospels to get the real thing, because the real thing is already in the Gospels. In addition, the doctrine of inspiration, if you really work it through, includes the fact that the Bible is breathed out by God, God who is Father, Son, Holy Spirit, therefore who is also Son, and therefore the entire Bible, including the Gospels, all four Gospels, are all the Word of Christ. So, in fact, you've got lots and lots of words of Christ, and not just in the Gospels. The Gospels are still precious to us because that time in the working out of God's purposes is so crucial, right, and so essential. But what we have is an authentic Word, even though it's not a comprehensive word, if you see the difference, right? Well, I'm using that word comprehensive almost in the technical sense. We say God is incomprehensible because his knowledge is infinite. He's incomprehensible. He's knowable. It's kind of similar with Jesus, right? The entire body, the comprehensive account, and how far do you have to go out, right? You would have to have every word. And then you would like to have the scene. You would like to have a video recording. You know, you press it out and out and out in order to have a comprehensive picture. What you have is a reliable picture, which in fact is a lot more digestible, and which in fact also brings out the theological significance, and that's important. One of the things people struggle with in the gospel studies in particular is they see theological motifs running through the gospels. And that includes differences where one gospel emphasizes one thing more than another. With the healing of the centurion slave, Luke emphasizes the humility of the centurion, that he sends representatives. you know, don't, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Matthew emphasizes his Gentile character, and the role of the Jewish intermediaries doesn't even come up for discussion. So in Matthew, the point is that the gospel goes out to the Gentiles. And then Luke, the point is that the gospel comes to the humble and is received in humility or not at all. Thank you. I'm glad that was a sound system and not an earthquake or something. But those two things are two sides of the same coin, for one thing, because if it has to be received in humility, then any sort of Jewish special claim is out. And if the Jews have no special claim, then neither does anybody else, right? So you have to come in humility. And the point is also, even more essential, that is, it is not an added meaning where an evangelist says, let me create a theological lesson out of this little story. But rather, it's God working redemption and working theological meaning in Jesus' interaction with the centurion. The very events themselves already are packed full of theology. Why? Because God controls history. So that the gospel writers are giving you a meaning which they did not create, which is actually already there in the events, but needs to be unpacked, needs to be explained. Now, I mean, this, I'm tempted to get onto the soapbox because this shows the difference between a Christian and non-Christian view of history. And it shows how it impinges on this kind of thing, right? Because a non-Christian view of history, the most obvious thing is to say, this is kind of theological creativity on the part of the gospel writers. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. We gotta, as historians, get back to the events, the facts, ma'am, the facts. This is Friday, you know, the dragnet, the old dragnet. I watched that growing up, it shows how old I am. The facts, don't overlay it with any of your interpretation. Well, Friday is right, you know, if it's just human interpretation, but if it's divine interpretation, then you know, events have innate meaning. This is Van Til all over again, no brute facts. Right? And what Van Til is doing at the level of apologetics, we ought to also do at the level of interpreting scripture, that the events are fraught with meaning from the beginning. Now, that also means, and meaning, yeah, the meaning ultimately in the mind and plan of God is infinite, right? It's all of history related to each event. And so it also means that any account whatsoever of those events is going to be a condensation in some respect. And there's where, you see, there you want a Christian epistemology and a Christian theology of knowledge where you say it's all right to be finite. The problem is not finiteness. The problem is sin. And finite knowledge can be completely true. And this goes back, I illustrated this, didn't I, with the diversity of the four Gospels? No, it's later. Sorry. Yeah, it's going to come up. But the fact is that you can be secure. You not only know the truth, but you're secure in your knowledge of the truth because God surrounds that on all sides. You know, He's done all of history. And He's done history so it's all linked, but not so that you can't understand a piece out of that. You can understand a piece without understanding everything because God understands everything and the piece and has so constructed all the pieces that finite understanding works That is, when you're in fellowship with God, it does not work. By the way, when you're not, because you end up twisting things, right? Well, probably enough there, unless you want to pursue. Yeah, okay. But that's a complicated question. I'm sorry I took so long. But, you know, part of the thing is that this course, it's not so much about content, it's about learning, right? How do you work through things in Scripture? So, you know, that's some excuse for my taking so long. Yeah.
What would you say is a unit for a section?
Yeah, the fact that a word can refer to something is a very, very deep mystery, because it's not a cause, you know, in a normal physical sense of cause. And ultimately, I think it goes back to the Trinitarian character of God. What else would you expect to hear from me? Yeah, words work not by being infinitely precise, you know, the idea of change over word meanings over time and things like that. They work not by each one being infinitely precise in of itself, but by working together in a context, narrowing down possibilities. And that too, it's kind of like you see the portrait of Mona Lisa and you take in all the parts, and it's a mystery how you fit it all together into, you know, a coherent whole. And the same is when you process even a single sentence. Very, very complicated. If you go into linguistics, you see some of the complexity, but the linguist can't get to the bottom of it because it involves an interaction between the human mind and material on a page or received auditorially. And so it is the individual, and then it's a community that has this language. Well, you see, once you have that, then it's a question of communication between the diversity of persons and the commonality of language, but that commonality learned through the diversity of, you know, language being learned by infants growing up, communicating with their parents and with their siblings. Well, that's all unity, diversity in human nature. It goes back to the unity and diversity in God, who speaks to himself. And I think without that, you end up being a deconstructionist. I think they've seen something about the fact that if you try to master language, that, and you try to pin everything down, like the butterfly on the display case, you end up crushing life out of it, and thus you end up eliminating the precise thing that you were after, namely what's going on in human communication. And human communication has that flexibility, and in fact it is a gift of God, because God himself is God in three persons. So the word God doesn't have that kind of monolithic precision, but it refers to three separate persons, right? It has this scope to it and that we do not fully understand. So, you know, I see the whole business of variation in language as a gift rather than a threat. But if you insist on being in the autonomous reason mold, then it becomes a threat. You either have to know something exhaustively, which is what Plato and Aristotle were after, or you abandon that and you know nothing really. And that's the polarity that I see. It's all the way through philosophy, and it comes out in modernism versus postmodernism. Modernism championing the Enlightenment and reason and mastery over language. And the postmodernists saying, in fact, you can't. And the postmodernists, some of them, including Jacques Derrida, the deconstructionist, he's an idol breaker. And when he's doing that, I say, go to it, Jacques. Yeah. Tear him apart. Whereas many evangelicals, they're just like, this guy is awful. Well, he's not a Christian. He's deeply anti-Christian. But he's deeply against some things that I'm against. So, in a way, what I'm getting at, I'm going to now punt to my book I've written in the beginning was The Word, all about language. So there are things there, I think, that we as Christians have to look at language in a different way than the world looks at it, namely as a gift of God. And as crafted by God to reveal his own character, but then also to communicate so that we can have finite true knowledge. You know, and I think you can work out ways in which language is wonderfully and beautifully crafted to do exactly that, but you will not work it out if you don't have confidence that God knows more than we do, because there comes an end to all human analysis, and the including analysis of language, that you can't see everything that is going on, you know, by way of a kind of divine insight and mastery. But the way I would deal with it in terms of the scripture is that, can you read a love letter and understand it? You know, can you talk to a friend and understand him? That's the way God talks to us. But, you know, I think postmodernism forces people back another stage in saying, how is it that succeeds when the analysis of postmodernism about the slipperiness of language would make us suspect that nothing could ever succeed? And I think the answer is that any communication always has to have a context. There's a contents of a social knowledge of language in the case of human communication. There's a context of an environment historically where, you know, if you're reading a love letter, it matters that it's my spouse or my boyfriend or girlfriend whom I already know about. Right? And so the context is working there. And the ultimate context, of course, is the context of God himself. And, I'm sorry to be going on, but I think maybe it's well if I tell you a little story. It's a story about one of my mentors, Kenneth Pike, who is a Christian who did Bible translation, and he also was he taught linguistics. And there was a class discussing his approach to language. And one of the themes that he has is that particular words and sentences and acts of communication and so on are always in a context. They're embedded in a larger context of human experience. So the class was discussing this and said, yeah, but where do you stop? Right? Because there are always larger and larger contexts that you need to interpret the smaller context. And somebody perceptively in the class said, that's just the point, that he does not stop. God is the last thing back. Whereas most of the linguistics of his time was actually reductionistic. We take sentences in isolation, we ask whether they're grammatical or ungrammatical, and so on. And so it was a strange point of view, but that's really saying the same message already over again. It's all right to be finite. You know, because God controls all these contexts, then even without mastering them all the way out, which you can't ever do, you can say it's safe, because we live in a created world, it's safe on the basis of the fact I and the other guy are created in the image of God. It's safe to communicate and to trust. Now, but in a sense, you're trusting God who's made the cosmos, and also trusting the other person is not going to be so wicked that everything is going to be falsified. Now, you know, people can try to get that way, but the common grace, nobody ever gets as bad as he could be. And a lot of communication actually succeeds. So I think the postmodernists, and particularly the deconstructionists, are dealing with real things, real issues. And I respect the questions. I don't agree with the answers. Right, and there's even an appendix in my language book about deconstruction specifically, and it's the book. In the beginning was the Word, and then the subtitle: Language, a God-centered approach. And I even talk about the problem of reference, because the deconstructionists see that words refer to things, but they refer using other words. And to explain what they refer to, you use still other words. So you've got a circle of meaning that goes out and out and out, and where does it stop? And they discuss the fact, is there a final, what they call a signified, that is the final reference. And they know well enough that God is a potential final signified. And there cannot be a final signified, because meaning goes on and on. And there's, you know, it's just a cycle of reference on and on. And they're convinced, and that destroys meaning, essentially, destroys the stability of meaning, right? Because everything is just in motion. But they're just this far away from the doctrine of the Trinity, because Christ signifies the Father. And the Father is not a signified in isolation from the other two persons of the Trinity. So, you know, I shake my head at that and I think, boy, that's that is so close. It is so counterfeit as well, you know, because these guys are anti-theists. Any more questions? Yeah. I did do one adult Sunday school class that was hermeneutical principles. And what I did was each week we'd take a passage, not the same passage every week, and I'd pick the passage appropriately, but we'd do sort of historical environment or issues of meaning or relationship between Old and New Testament, or relationship to Christ. So every week there would be something illustrated. But I felt it was better, you know, here it's more principles, right, and their illustration dropped out. There it started with the illustration, because people, you know, can grab that a little more. So I did that once. I was invited, now we've moved to another church, I was invited to do such a course at the other church, and I found that I was resisting doing it, even though I've told this class, you know, think about doing it. And I think the reason why is that for some people, and maybe for many people, it's better caught than taught. That is, if you just do it over and over again. So what I've done, it's now our home church, is I've done a series of Sunday school classes, not one right after the other, but from time to time. So I've done, well, I've played to things I'm really interested in, so I've not done sort of everything equally that's hermeneutical. But I've taught Christ in the Psalms, Christ in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, Christ in Isaiah, and Christ in Genesis. And maybe there's a few more. But you see, what I'm doing in each of those is I'm trying to set a pattern for how people can think about these books. And at the same time, I'm not giving them a lot of principles. I'm just saying you look for instance of a mediator, and then I'm doing that, and you. So, in some ways, depending on your audience, if I'm doing a seminary class, clearly I'm not going to do it that way, because people want to see what's the substructure, and how can I have some general principles to do it? But I'm leery, in fact, of trying to learn general principles apart from examples. Because I don't think, in the end, that's the way human nature works. And if you believe Antill, you believe in the equal ultimacy of the one and the many. And the many is the examples, and the one is the principle, you see. That's one way of looking at it. So how does the Bible teach the nature of redemption? Well, it has general statements, right, particularly in the letters, about the nature of salvation. But those general statements correlate with the Exodus from Egypt and with David fighting Goliath. And you may succeed better and bring the gospel home with the story of David and Goliath than expounding Paul's letter sometimes, right? It's both and, obviously. I'll tell you another little story. When I was a student, I got involved in a church that had a ministry with, it was an old people's home, essentially, a nursing home. And we would go once a month. Some other churches went the other Sundays. On Sunday, we would go, a bunch of us, and we would have a little worship service in this nursing home. And they would sing some hymns, and you'd try to pick the old hymns that people knew and that kind of thing. Sing some hymns, and they have a little sermonette, right? Maybe 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, because most of these people are senile. Their attention span is limited. Their intellectual capacity is limited. But many of them are Christian believers, right? You want to care for them in their later years, so that they live in the faith and are nourished in the faith even then. So anyway, I'm going there, and occasionally I'm asked to give a little sermonette. Well, that's good for me, good for you if you get involved that way, because if the people are senile, then you gotta work. And I thought, how am I ever going to do this? And I would tell stories from the Gospels. Jesus healing the leper. You feel unclean, you feel dirty. The leper was dirty, symbolically dirty. Well, here's symbolism. And Jesus heals him, touches him, identifies with the uncleanness, identifies with your sin, takes it to himself that you may be clean. That's going to work with somebody, possibly, you know, because the Lord has to work. But the point is, that's an entrance point for somebody who's been sexually abused as a child. And typically, people like that feel dirty, unconquerably dirty. Or somebody who's been deeply involved in sin. It's not sinned against, but sin against others. If you will, you can make me clean. I am willing. Be clean. You see the vividness of that, right? And so, and my point is, yeah, going back to the hermeneutics, an example that actually embodies redemption is just as powerful as the general principle. And in the end, equal ultimacy of one and many, we do not know the general principles apart from the examples and vice versa. Right? The example makes no sense, except if you see its significance. Okay, let's stop there.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.